You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cleese Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 287 of the Earth Station DCU! Tonight we're going to talk Batman Catwoman number 11, Batman 89 number 5, Flashpoint number 0, Naomi season 2 number 2, Batman Urban Legends number 14, Batgirls number 5, I Am Batman number 8, Green Lantern number 12, Superman Son of Kal-El number 10, Wonder Woman number 786, The Flash season 8 episode 12, Death Rises, and DMZ Season 1, Episode 4, Home. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, first up for DC news. Amanda Waller's series is in development at HBO Max. Viola Davis is supposed to return.
Normally, Drew, I'd be a little bit surprised about doing a series around Amanda Waller. Not because it doesn't make sense to do it. Like, that is an interesting character, I think, to do a miniseries around. But, like, you know, I don't think she'd be in my top 10 characters of likelihood to get a series. But considering the actress that they have playing her and, you know, obviously how talented she is, that doesn't totally surprise me because, I mean, Viola Davis is awesome. And she's been great as Amanda Waller. And if she's willing to do more, I totally get trying to build a series around her.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I also think it has a lot to do with Peacemaker being successful, too.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. And you have to assume it's going to have some relation to Suicide Squad. It might not. It's possible you can do an Amanda Waller story that is essentially a Suicide Squad, but with her as the main character, or they could be going in a different direction. We can be seeing her, you know, doing more of her kind of behind the scenes bureaucratic stuff. So it'd be kind of interesting to see if this does, you know, continue to move forward as a project, what direction they go with it. Because I feel like there's several different things you could do with that character and with a series based around that character.
I'm curious if James Gunn is involved in this at all. I didn't see anything saying he was, but I wouldn't be surprised.
It's possible. I mean, I think he's just recently finished filming Guardians, I think. So, you know, give it like, what, 6 months, a year or so? I would imagine at that point that would be whenever he'd be working on this next thing. So, I don't know. It'd be interesting to see. You know, he's involved with Peacemaker season 2, so interesting. It'll be interesting to see, Drew. I'm intrigued. I like the idea of doing this. You know, obviously, I don't think all of these projects that they announce are going to come to fruition, but I would definitely be interested if it does ultimately come out.
Now, talking about things not coming to fruition, the Wonder Twins HBO Max movie has been canceled.
Which is, didn't they just announce the casting for this?
Yes.
I feel like we did a week ago we talked about the casting, and then literally like a day or two after we talked about it, this news came out that they're canceling the project, which I'm bummed in theory, Drew, because I really wanted to see a project based around Mark Russell's Wonder Twins, because I really think that would have been pretty good and pretty funny. On the other hand, based on the casting that they did with it, I don't know if it would have been that good, so I don't know if I'm that upset about it. I'm not sure.
I heard that a lot of projects are getting the axe because of Discovery purchasing Warner Brothers.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And we kind of saw that when AT&T acquired Warner Bros. And we saw some reconfiguring of stuff. I'm curious to see, Drew, and it's always tough because you can't tell right away how things are going to go. But I'm curious, they've given it in a year or two, if we're going to see any noticeable real like shifts in what we're seeing from DC, both in live media as well as the imprint.
Yeah, I'm wondering, and I'm thinking that's what's behind the Batwoman cancellation and the Legends cancellation too. So, changing of the guard,
Yeah.
trying to trim the fat.
And if I and honestly, I mean, obviously I'm biased because I don't like the shows, but it really, like, if you're going to trim the fat on your projects that are out there, I mean, like, the CW stuff feels like the most obvious things to get rid of.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that.
For multiple reasons. I mean, one, they just aren't as good. They just aren't. Even if you enjoy them, I don't think you can compare the quality of The Flash to the quality of Peacemaker. I mean, they're just not on the same level of show. Understandably, because they don't have the same level budget. But on top of that, you want people using HBO Max. You want people getting that content from you directly. You know what I mean? On the HBO Max streaming service. So it makes sense in that regard. Also, even if Flash was absolutely killing it, right? You would rather them be watching that stuff on your app and not on the CW.
Yeah, totally agree. All right, up next for DC News, John Paul Valley, aka Azrael, is getting a six-part miniseries titled Sword of Azrael, debuting this August, written by Dan Waters and illustrated by Nicola Cismizia, the same creative team that brought you Sword of Azrael, Dark Knight, and Batman Urban Legends numbers 8 through 10.
I'm not super excited by this, Drew, because, I don't feel that strongly about Azrael. But there were parts of that story I liked. We talked about this. Most of that mini series I did not care for. But when they flash back to the Knights Templar, I got really, really intrigued by that part of the story. And if they can tap into a little bit of that, this series has the potential to catch my interest.
Me, I've never really been a big fan of Jean Paul Valley Azrael. I mean, I really like the Nightfall storyline when it came out, but I've never really been a big fan of Azrael. And I remember them trying to make him into something back in the 90s, even after Nightfall. But honestly, I'm not really excited about the miniseries. And they're titling it The Sword of Azrael. I think that's what the original miniseries was called back in the 80s. Or, not 80s, 90s. Early 90s. So, I'm like, you guys couldn't come up with a different title than that?
But that might be the point, though, too. They might be wanting to play on the nostalgia of that.
That could be. But
I
this
mean,
is the
but you have to
set.
admit, Drew, one of the kind of hallmarks of the era that we're in right now is the 90s nostalgia.
That's true. We've been seeing a lot of that lately. All right, and for our last bit of DC news, legendary comic book artist George Perez has passed away. He was 67 years old. Perez announced his cancer diagnosis in December, revealing that he had stage 3 pancreatic cancer, and Perez told fans at the time that he had elected to forego chemotherapy, which he was told had a low chance of success, and instead spent as much quality time as he could with family, friends, and fans.
Really sad news, Drew. I mean, what a bummer that two podcasts in a row we have to, discuss the passing of two legendary DC artists. On the one hand, it is comforting to know that in a sense he knew the end was coming, was able to spend it as best he could. And obviously you kind of always wish that for anybody. But it's still sad. And I don't know about you, Drew, because I know, I mean, because he was so ubiquitous in his heyday. For me, when I mean, because obviously he's a little bit before me, I always associate him with the new Teen Titans. It's always the first, like if you say George Perez, and I know he did so many other things, but that's the first thing for me that always pops in my head.
Yeah, that's usually what pops in my head first too, and I loved his miniseries with Marv Wolfman on the A Lonely Place of Dying. That's one of my favorites. I started reading it around the time that I started collecting comics, so they worked on that together, and it went back and forth between Batman and New Titans. So love that miniseries they did. I always think of that. I always think of Crisis on Infinite Earths, of course. And George Perez was also at CrossGen in the early 2000s, which I loved CrossGen at the time before it tanked. So he was there for a while. Great artwork, loved it. And I actually met him at Indiana Comic Con. Oh, probably. I'm guessing it's 6, 7 years ago. Really nice guy. Had the f longest line to see him when he was there, but it was worth it. He's gonna be missed, that's for sure.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right. Well, that wraps up our DC news for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
We have 30 seconds to describe Thunder Talk.
We got big interviews.
Super red music.
We're proud members of the ESO network.
Yeah, they're probably gonna fire us.
I wouldn't blame them.
We've got jokes.
Adult jokes.
And nerd junk.
Woke nerd junk.
All the woke nerd junk.
Find Thunder Talk on the internet.
And the ESO network.
Ta-da!
Hi, I'm Joe Heath.
And I'm Tony Heath.
And we're the hosts of the Watchathon of Rassilon,
a podcast where we're watching through all of Doctor Who.
And we're just about finished with the classic series.
Depending on when you hear this, we may already be done.
So why not go check for yourself?
And while you're there, why not go ahead and listen to every single episode of the Watchathon of Rassilon?
And watch as Joe loses his last little tenuous grip on sanity.
The Watchathon of Rassilon, a proud member of the ESO Network.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers!
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 We got spoilers!
Spoilers!
For you! We got spoilers!
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 We've got spoilers!
Spoilers!
For you! For you!
All right, let's talk Batman Catwoman number 11. Dick Grayson wants to know where Selina is. Helena tells him they fought. Selina won. Selina ran. Later on, when Helena returns to the Batcave, Dick Grayson is waiting for her. Dick asks her again where Selina is. Helena replies, "If you want the mantle, come and take it. Otherwise, get the F out of my cave." Catwoman hides Riddler from Batman in a dumpster. Riddler tells Selina a riddle, and when she doesn't respond to it, Riddler gives his hiding place away to Batman, trying to explain the riddle to Catwoman. I know that was pretty funny, wasn't it? Batman and Catwoman work together to take down Joker, who is dressed like a toy soldier. Joker throws a present, but it's a fruitcake, not a bomb. Batman and Catwoman both take down Joker and then kiss under the mistletoe. The Phantasm has come to kill the Joker. Joker has a baby in his arms. Joker throws the baby into the air and escapes while the Phantasm catches him. Thinking the baby is now an orphan, Andrea raises him as her own son. After Dick leaves the Batcave, Helena goes into the mansion and has a talk with her mother, Selina. Selina is reminiscing over a photo of Bruce in a Superman costume and Helena in her fairy costume at Halloween time. Selina and Helena hug, making up. The issue ends with Andrea taking her own blade and killing herself in front of Batman and Selina, blaming herself what had happened to the baby and to the baby's real family.
Brutal ending. I'm always eager when we get these miniseries to get the next issue because obviously I want more of the story. But I really want the last issue of this, Drew, because I feel like we need it to piece everything together. We got, I think, a pretty decent piece today where this helped put together, I thought was a little bit confusing with what was going on with the kid and the parents in the last couple issues. I felt like this kind of explained that better, and now we have a better understanding that it was never really her kid, and she just mistakenly thought that, you know, he had nobody, and turns out he did the whole time, and she just kind of kept him from the family. So that helped Drew, but we've gotten all of these, like, pieces, right? But they don't form a picture yet, I don't think. And we just got to get that last issue, I think, to kind of slot everything into place. So I'm very much looking forward to the end, obviously because I want to read the next issue, but also because I really think it's going to bring everything together and kind of bring into focus what we've really been reading about.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman 89, number 5. Two-Face has a discussion with Mr. Karp about his armored car heist. Two-Face takes over the remnants of the Joker gang and decides to steal $31 million out of the police headquarters evidence room. Commissioner Gordon tells Barbara that he has handed in his resignation effective Monday. Batman and Robin are being chased by Gotham police when all patrol cars are pulled away. Alfred informs the Batman that there are 4 explosions in the subway tunnels, all equal distance from police headquarters. Police headquarters is being evacuated because of a gas leak. Commissioner Gordon realizes that GCPD is under attack and puts up the bat signal. When Batman gets to the rooftop, some of Two-Face's men are about to attack Commissioner Gordon. Batman and Commissioner Gordon come across Two-Face. Two-Face attacks Batman with one of his batarangs. Commissioner Gordon falls unconscious from a knockout dart. Batman saves Bullock, who's been shot, while Two-Face escapes with the money and Gordon as a hostage. The cops have Batman surrounded when he brings out Bullock. Robin plows through the cops on the motorcycle like they are bowling pins and rescues Batman. The knockout dart that Batman accidentally hit Commissioner Gordon with has a tracker in it. Batman and Robin track Commissioner Gordon to a florist shop. Two-Face meets with Barbara in the park. Barbara tries to arrest him. Catwoman shows up and attacks Barbara. Two-Face goes back to Gordon and then ends up shooting him in the chest. Batman shows up. Next, we're going to have the battle for Gotham. I thought this issue was all over the place, Cletus. I mean, yeah. We have Catwoman coming in out of nowhere. You have Robin plowing through policemen like they're bowling pins. I'm like, really? That doesn't seem like something they would do. I don't know. It felt less like the movie stuff in this issue than we've seen in previous issues. I just thought it was all over the place and wasn't being very cohesive. Kind of chaotic.
I don't disagree at all, Drew. I don't understand why Catwoman was even in the issue. Like, what was the point of that scene? I don't understand. Like, I know they brought her in a few issues ago, and it almost feels like they put her in there because they know that people like the Michelle Pfeiffer Catwoman, not because it made any sense for her to be part of the story.
I totally agree.
Hopefully I'm proven wrong and there is some actual purpose or reason for it next issue, but I'm kind of dubious that it will, Drew. I mean, it's a little late in the game at this point. And then a couple things. One, it's been way too long since the last issue of this came out. I mean, I don't understand what the delay was. I know there's so many different reasons behind these comic delays with shipping and all that. I get it, but still. So I had forgotten a little bit, to be honest. But then, like you said, it's all over the place. It felt the least like the films. I agree with you on that, too. It's not very good. It just was not a very good issue. And it stuck out because the rest of them have been at least fine. I wouldn't say any of the issues have been like unbelievably good necessarily, but this stuck out clearly as the worst issue of this run so far.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And after I read it, it made me think back to the Superman 78 and how that felt so closely like the movie, and how this issue just felt like it deviated clear away from it. So it stuck out like a sore thumb.
Agreed.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Flashpoint Beyond number 0. Batman teams up with Mime and Marinette to find Janie Slater's watch in Rip Hunter's time vault. Janie Slater was a scientist and John Osterman's girlfriend, who left him when he cheated on her and was later given cancer as part of Ozymandias' plot to save humanity. Penguin wakes up Dr. Thomas Wayne, who fell asleep drinking at his desk. Judge Dent is there, demanding Thomas go visit his wife Gilda in Arkham. She will only talk with Thomas because she has become obsessed with Martha. We also learn that Dent's daughter Debbie took her own life because she was haunted by the Joker's awful laugh. Judge Dent demands Thomas sees Gilda or he will prosecute Thomas Wayne for the murder of Joe Chill. Thomas is confused and enraged that the Flashpoint world still exists. Thomas knows that Barry changed it because Reverse Flash ripped him out of time. He tried to convince Bruce not to become Batman at one point, and Thomas should even be dead because Darkseid had killed him. Instead, Thomas is back in the Flashpoint world. Thomas is in the Batcave and sees "Everything Matters" written on a chalkboard. Thomas wonders who the hell wrote that. He shouts through the Batcave, wondering if Thawne is back. Thomas seeks out Barry and tries to convince him to change things back, but Barry doesn't want to hear it. Thomas kidnaps Barry and tries to recreate the lightning strike that gave Barry his powers. Someone shoots the chemicals with a harpoon, spilling them on the ground. When the lightning strikes, Barry is killed. Penguin radios Thomas and tells him the police are on their way to arrest Thomas for the murder of Joe Chill. Dent's car blows up, but Batman is able to save his son Dexter. Thomas offers Dexter a place to stay. Gilda demands to see Thomas Wayne when she learns that Harvey Dent is dead, and Thomas has offered Dexter a place to stay. Roger Hayden, the psycho pirate, who is also in Arkham, realizes everything is upside down again and wonders where Bruce is. Bruce Wayne is in the Batcave and being warned by a kid in a raccoon hat that his actions could threaten all of space and time. Divine Continuum itself. To be continued in Flashpoint Beyond number 1.
I'm going to be honest, Drew. I don't really care for this. It's pretty consistent with... I'm glad that we had the kind of refresher and reprint of the old Thomas Wayne tie-ins to Flashpoint, because it is obviously the artist is the same and the tone is generally the same. I just was just a little too dour for me, I guess. And I it's not that I don't like those kind of comics. I just, for some reason, it was just too much. It just felt like it was just so focused on being dour and being a big, you know, downer for the reader. I was like, but like, you got to give me something to keep reading here. Like, if you just want to depress me, like, I can do something else.
See, it had the opposite effect on me. I was intrigued with the story, and I was curious what was going on. Why Thomas was back in the Flashpoint, and was it they kind of hinted at maybe it was something Bruce Wayne did, but I don't know. I think that's kind of trying to throw us off the track. I think somebody else is behind it, and I'm curious to find out who.
I guess for me, Drew, I got too meta with that, and it was sort of like, well, the reason that you're back in this world is because a writer has decided to write this world again. I know that that's not the answer story-wise, but we've been doing so much metafictional stuff with the multiverse. You know, obviously Williamson is heavily adapting what Grant Morrison did. And frankly, Drew, let's be honest, Grant Morrison would use that as an answer. So, I don't know. That mystery didn't really intrigue me that much, because I was like, I know that's not the answer in the world, but that was so, it was just like, the only reason the Flashpoint story is even relevant is because someone has chosen to write a Flashpoint story. It's not like we're reading Batman, the active ongoing series, and all of a sudden we're in the Flashpoint world. I think then the mystery would stick out more to me, personally.
I don't know. I was excited about it. I was excited to get Geoff Johns' story again, and I was excited that it was good instead of crappy like Williamson stuff.
Right. Well, yeah, I know. Don't get me wrong. I don't think the writing is bad in this. Obviously, Geoff Johns has written some stuff that's pretty dark. Like, Blackest Night isn't exactly a stroll in the park. I don't know, Drew. There was just something about it that was just, like, a little bit too dour for me. I don't know what it was. Like, I thought it was really unnecessary to have had the 8-year-old daughter kill herself because of the Joker. I was like, come on, I understand you're trying to emphasize how, like, grim and nasty this world is and why, you know, it's a tragedy that it exists again, but like, did we need that? Couldn't you have come up with something else?
Yeah, that is depressing, but
you know what I mean, Drew? Like, that felt unusual for Johns for me. Like, if you had told me that Azzarello wrote that, I think it would bother me less, because I'd be like, yeah, that's Brian Azzarello, it's kind of what he does. But, like, I felt like for Geoff Johns, having a, you know, obviously, now, granted, they didn't actually show us that, thank God. I don't know, man. Having a, you know, like, 8 or 9-year-old girl kill herself is not my idea of a good time in a story.
It ain't mine, I can tell you that. Okay, so you get me all depressed about this issue, Cletus.
Now, to be clear, I still think this can go in an interesting place. I'm not out on this series. I came in expecting to like this issue quite a bit. And so it kind of surprised me a little bit when I finished it. And I was like, oh, you know, I didn't really enjoy myself when I read that. That being said, I certainly still want to read the next issue. Especially because issue zeros, I feel like sometimes are kind of hit and miss, whether they feel like the real story or not. So I'm a little bit interested to get to issue one to see if there's a tonal shift. I know we're getting an art shift in that, and I think that might be beneficial as well. So we'll see. Like I said, I'm certainly not out on the series by any means. Just kind of curious to see where they're going to go next.
And I have to agree with you about issue number zero. Sometimes those feel a little different or a little extra compared to number ones and going into a series. I've noticed that over the years too, so I have to agree with you on that. So yeah, we'll have to see how issue one is. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Naomi season 2, number 2, Dee's Garage, Port Oswego. Naomi is looking for Dee, but it finds her dad instead. Naomi's dad tells her to go home. Naomi demands to know more about a Thanagarian pin she found and what her father knows about Thanagarians. Naomi's father just tells her Ran and Thanagar have been in a holy war for a long time. The police show up during a security check, and Naomi flies her father out of there. Naomi's father is angry with her for manhandling him. Naomi shows the Thanagarian pin to Hawkgirl, and Hawkgirl tells her it's offensive, like a Gestapo offensive. Hawkgirl gives Naomi a 3-hour lecture on the history of the Thanagarian Blackguard and the Ran-Thanagar War. Naomi returns home to her father and tells him he was right and the two make up. Naomi can't sleep, so she goes superheroing. Naomi fights an alien monster, stops a bank robber in Bloodhaven, saves a child from drowning. Naomi helps the metal men fight Cyborg Superman, and we even see Naomi fight Solomon Grundy. Naomi comes across an incident at Star Labs where a person who looked like Hawkman had just killed a guy's supervisor. The Hawkman lookalike had a multiverse map and demanded to be sent to some coordinates. Naomi goes to the lab to get the coordinates when Cyborg appears out of a porthole telling Naomi to close the porthole now. To be continued.
Drew, I got whiplash from the portrayal of the dad. I'm just almost lost at this point.
I know what you mean. I'm like, they made it CW dramatic when it didn't need to be. And, you know, they made it all dramatic and then they make up. I'm like, why did we even do this? It was
intensely dramatic, Drew. Like, You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't just like, oh, my dad's a little mad at me. I'm an angsty teen. It was like, my dad might potentially have killed someone, and then he is intensely antagonistic to his daughter, and then they're fine, and he's just painting minifigures in the garage. I was like, what is happening? And then the same thing on the reverse with D. All of a sudden, we go from, you know, him being her closest ally to potentially essentially being an SS officer for the Thanagarians. Like, what is happening here, Drew? I'm sure that's going to be a fake out too, or like a maybe he was involved in that once and he's since redeemed himself and gone on a different path. But either way, I don't anticipate him being a villain outright either. So I don't know, Drew. I also was a little bit confused by it felt like there was a little bit of a time jump there, Drew. I don't know about you, where we reversed back to when she first got her powers and talked to the Justice League.
That whole beginning, what was the point of that? I didn't even see the point of that in the story. I'm like, I didn't even bother putting it in my notes because I didn't understand what the point or what it had to do with this story.
Well, it confused me initially because I was like, wait, is this story supposed to have happened pre-Justice League? Because why? Also, I don't think that's right based on the first issue. And then it wasn't. And then it clearly was some sort of, you know, flashback thing. But like you said, why? Why? I don't know. Again, not a bad issue, but I don't know, man.
Now, I have to agree with you. I thought the D thing's a fake out, too. I'm wondering if it's actually a different Thanagarian, and maybe D's chasing after him or something. I don't know. I'm expecting it not to be D either, but maybe, you know, I could be wrong. Maybe he is gonna be bad or something. I don't know. If that's the case, it's like his character's doing a 180 or something, and definitely didn't fit in with the show version of D. So
that might not matter though.
Yeah, it might not. But I guess we'll have to see what happens next issue. Why Cyborg suddenly popping up in this and what's going on? So maybe we'll get some sort of explanation. I was expecting Naomi to go through the portal, but she might not. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batman Urban Legends number 14. Our first story in this is Batman and Zatanna in Bound to Our Will, Part 4 of 6. John Constantine is absorbed by Eos. Batman and Zatanna fight Eos and Celeste, but are losing. Batman takes on Eos by himself to give Zatanna a chance to get away. Batman is sent to the in-between where he finds Constantine. Constantine powers up Batman, who goes after Eos from the in-between. Next, we're going to get the Escape the Dark. I don't know about you, Cletus, but I'm starting to lose interest in this story.
Agree completely. I'm also, like, I think part of the reason I'm losing interest is because it's losing me plot-wise a little bit. Like, I'm kind of having a hard time following the story at this point. I don't feel like I fully grasp who Eos and her partner are. I don't know. I kind of don't, and I also kind of don't care at this point either.
I understand where you're coming from. I think the main thing I got from the story is Batman and Zatanna open some door that's stuck open, and they need to find a way to close it to stop these people. That's what I got out of the story.
Right, yeah, which we've known since the first issue of this, so not great progress plot-wise.
No, and we actually got two parts left of the story, so I bet it's just going to feel like it's dragging on.
Which is crazy because it's not like any of these segments are particularly long. Like, they just aren't doing a whole lot. Like, they've had some interesting bits and pieces. Like, obviously it was incredibly tragic, but like following the man who got possessed, like his life and like how he just got like the short straw every turn, and then finally he just gets possessed by a guy, and it was just like, wow, that was sad. So, like, there have been some interesting parts to this, but on the whole, it's just kind of lost me.
Same with me. All right, our next story is Batman and the Question in Right Answer, Wrong Question. The Question comes to Gotham looking for answers about Bruce Wayne. The Question learns that Batman is Bruce Wayne and that he can be trusted.
grand. This was fine, but I sort of, when I finished it, Drew, I was like, why? I mean, I like that it was a little mini story with Question and Batman, and I guess maybe if there was a burning question for somebody out there that was like, oh, but how did they learn to trust each other? I guess now you figured it out, but like, I don't know, man. I feel like there could have been something else we could have done that would have been a little more interesting.
I agree with you, because this felt like a story that's probably been told before, or, you know, we know the Question already knows who Batman is now. I mean, why are we going back to something in the past like this? I don't know. I just thought it we could have had a better story. All right, well, let's move on to the next story. It is Birds of Prey in Memory Lane, Part 1 of 3. Shiva, Katana, Ghost, and Miracle Molly team up to take down Noah Grove, who uses people's memories against them. The ladies fight Noah, hiding in an old vacation home of Arkham Asylum's founder. Next, we're going to get the Nightmare of Noah Grave. Got to tell you, Cletus, my first problem with this story is calling it Birds of Prey, because the Birds of Prey are Oracle, Black Canary, and Huntress, not this group.
That's fair. That's fair. I didn't have the same problem with it, with that, but I also didn't totally care for the story either. Just because, like at one point, Katana uses the app, right? And it clearly does not go well. And it feels like the team should have been aware of that happening, because they're right there in the background and nobody says anything about it. And they just sort of keep moving in the story. And I was like, well, what was the point of that scene? I don't think that was good. I don't know, man. I guess I could say the next issue might help it make a little more sense or make it a little better, but I feel like I'm just going to get more of the same next issue of this.
Yeah, I didn't care for it, as I obviously pointed out. All right, and our last story in this issue is Ace the Bat Hound in Hounded, Part 4 of 6. Batman is to be auctioned off to the highest bidder. Bat Hound continues to look for Batman while trying to get the other pits to safety. Russell was trying to make a point in this, and I can't remember what it was now, but it didn't feel like it moved the story along to me. It felt like it was kind of spinning its wheels with this issue.
I think that's fair, Drew, but I think, I don't know, I think part of this is all is just, I mean, with a lot of Russell's stuff, the story is oftentimes a vehicle for him to sort of, you know, kind of draw attention to and point out some, you know, flaws in humanity and our society. And it's like, again, with like the stories in this one, he kind of, like, he uses the Russian story of the bears, you know, and that being about human greed. And then the other story about the king, you know, and again, it all kind of ties into this idea that, you know, wealth does not necessarily come by well, so to speak. Like, you might not necessarily be a great person always if you're involved in stuff like this, and that it might not necessarily make you happy either. I don't know. Like, so it felt very consistent in, like, his messaging, so to speak. But I would agree it didn't necessarily move the story that forward either. But I also, I don't know that that was sort of the point either. I mean, if we really boil it down, Drew, it's Ace the Bat Hound and Batman go on a mission. Batman gets captured, and then ultimately he's going to get set free by Ace, right? Like, we all kind of know how the story is going to end. And I think Russell knows that. I don't think he's trying to hide that, right? And I think it's more, I don't think the story is about Batman getting free. I think it's about, you know, what the story says about people and how they treat animals and all, and, you know, just the rot of greed to begin with.
Yeah, I remember he had messages throughout this. I just forgot what they were already. I know that's sad, but I guess it just didn't stick with me. So
that's fair. No, that's fair. I mean, and, you know, I mean, that's obviously going to, your mileage may vary, I think, with any Mark Russell story. If you don't care for his satire and his social commentary, you probably aren't going to like some of his stuff. But if that is the sort of thing that intrigues you, I think that's kind of what you come to the table for. I think that's what you want out of a Mark Russell story. And for me, you know, I enjoyed this entry. I agree with you, Drew. Plot-wise, not a ton happened. It didn't really move the plot forward all that much. I do not disagree with you on that. But I, for me, that's not my expectation of this story, because that's kind of, often the plot is not really the main thing you're supposed to take away from one of Russell's stories. I'll compare this, and I know that might sound a little hypocritical when I talk about other issues not moving the plot forward, but like, for comparison's sake, Williamson, and I know I pick on him all the time, but let's be honest, he is very much a plot-based writer, right? Like, his is very much about the next big reveal and the next big status quo change. And maybe you might like some of those status quo changes, and that's great, right? But that's what it's about. And so when he writes a story that doesn't really move the plot forward, that is an indictment on that issue, because that's, frankly, what his writing is focused on, is the plot. And it is moving the story forward and changing your view of the DC universe or the DC character that you're reading. And I think that's just a stylistic difference. I don't think that's what, I mean, obviously Mark Russell's stories have plots. I understand that. But I, like, we talk about All-Star Squadron. There's certainly a plot in that, right? There is a story, but is that really the main focus of the story? Is it really an exploration of, like, Red Tornado's soul? You know what I mean? I think there's just a little bit of a difference in what the writers want out of their story.
And maybe I was disappointed with this story because it didn't have the usual funniness as a lot of his stories have in it, too. And yeah. I've liked some of the other issues of the Ace story, but I don't know. This one just didn't do it for me.
No, and that's fair. I mean, because really the only particularly funny scene was the squirrel stealing a piece of pizza for the bear, which is, like, humorous. I mean, but not, like, not that funny, right? It's just compared to the, you know, I mean, like, this has not been a particularly happy story. This has definitely been one of the darker stories I think he's written, with the level of violence that we've seen and the cruelty that we've seen towards these various animals. So I agree with you, Drew. I mean, it is a little bit different from him, and it's a lot of the bite that his satire has without a lot of the laughter that usually helps kind of ease that a little bit.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Batgirls number 5. The Batgirls are being chased by the Saints in a creepy white van. The Batgirls play chicken with them, and Stephanie decides to jump on the top of the van. Barbara shows up on her Batgirl motorcycle to save her. The Saints bring in Fido 5 robot, and Barbara hacks into it and uses it against the Saints. When the Batgirls have stopped the Saints, Barbara gives them proof that Simon Saint is dead, and they have been played by Seer. The Batgirls leave the Saints for the police. Stephanie gets a live stream from Tudor on her phone. Barbara triangulates the signal and sends Fido to find Tudor. Oracle is able to discover information about Tudor. His real name is Cody Klein. He graduated high school from Gotham Academy and then went on to study art at Gotham University. After finishing his Bachelor's of Arts degree, Cody was busted for some minor infractions, including graffiti and trespassing. A few years ago, Cody suffered a psychotic break after one of Scarecrow's fear gas attacks. Cody was put on a 72-hour hold at Arkham Asylum. Oracle has tracked Tudor to Arkham Asylum and has sent the Batgirls there. Barbara tells the Batgirl she hasn't heard from Charles Dante since Tudor broke free. Barbara says she's going to log off the comms and go check on him. Stephanie and Cassie find some old files at Arkham. Stephanie discovers that Charles Dante was Tudor's doctor at Arkham. Barbara gets captured by Spellbinder, and then Tudor has an army of mind-controlled people ready to take out the Batgirls. I gotta tell you, Cletus, one of the things that threw me off when I started reading this issue was the Saints chasing after the Batgirls, because I was like, wait a minute, did I miss an issue? I don't remember them chasing after them at the end of the last issue. And I actually went back to the last issue to look, and sure enough, that's not what was going on. So I started off the issue a little confused. And then, you know, the story finishes with the Saints and then gets back to the Tudor stuff that, you know, we left off with last time.
So this was interesting to me that they at one point use an editor's note to clarify that the Saints who think that they've been sent this mission by Simon Saint have been obviously been actually tricked. But that editor's note, again, Drew, I really think that there was a change in the story at one point. It was either supposed to be Simon Saint, or it was supposed to, at least we were supposed to think it could have been Simon Saint at one point when they initially wrote this story. And then obviously things changed. Simon Saint was killed. I know that they show that it was never really him giving the hit. I understand that. But this felt to me like a kind of a cleanup attempt to be like, hey, just to be clear, we understand, we're on the same page. We know Simon Saint is dead. But also, let's maybe just wrap up these characters and kind of put them off the table for a little bit, just so we can kind of like refocus and put them away for a while. That felt to me, Drew, like a little bit of a kind of change of course.
Yeah, maybe that's why I was so thrown off at the beginning of this issue with them, you know, chasing after the Batgirls when we left the last issue. They weren't doing that. That makes total sense that something changed and they're trying to fix it and get them off the table to, you know, it said they could possibly come back later. And maybe they will, maybe they won't. I honestly don't really interested in the Saints. I'm done with Simon Saint and all his crap.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't mind, I wouldn't be shocked if we see them come back again, but I think if we do see them come back in this title, I think they will be refocused, and I think they will be more explicit in that they're not coming directly from Simon Saint this time, because I really, Drew, they initially debuted that team. I genuinely think that we were supposed to think it was at least possible that they were coming from Simon Saint. And then, but obviously when the story actually came out, that didn't work, that didn't make sense anymore. And I could be wrong, but knowing what we know with some of the editorial mess that we've seen with some of these books, I really think this felt like a course correction to me.
I agree with you. I mean, there was a lot of editor notes in this, so that does make sense.
The other thing, and you mentioned it, talking about this issue, is like you said, they come out of nowhere and just kind of wrap up these Saints so they can take them off the table, and then they go on with the story that they had been trying to focus on previous issue. And there was almost too much going on in this issue. Like, I got to what I thought was the end of the story, and then it kept going for like another 5 or 6 pages. And it wasn't necessarily because I thought it was a natural ending to the story. It was just like, wow, so much has happened. Surely it's got to be wrapping up soon. And then it just kind of kept going. It was a little too busy, I thought.
I have to agree with you, Cletus, because I got to the part of the story where I thought it was going to end too, and it kept going. I'm like, this feels weird. Because it felt like it should have ended at one point, but it still kept going. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. I Am Batman number 8. Batman is ready to fight, but Man Ray seems to think Batman is going to be his partner. Man Ray is surprised when Batman punches him. When Man Ray starts to fight back, Batman is losing. Batman escapes out the window and runs away on his motorcycle. The mayor is pleased that hundreds of black market guns have been taken off the street by Detective Chubb and Whitaker in cooperation with Batman. The police commissioner is less than thrilled and leaves the press conference. Batman calls Detective Chubb and gives her a location in Bushwick to send tactical units to. Jace calls Lucius and tells him that he didn't go after Man Ray, instead he ran. Lucius tells Jace the other Batman has done the same thing a number of times. Jace doesn't want to hear it. Jace ran because he was scared. Man Ray stating he was out there killing people because of Batman really bothered Chase. Man Ray abducts the commissioner and cuts him up. The commissioner states that he sees he was wrong about Batman. He sees that now. Man Ray says, "I see," then takes out the commissioner's eyeballs. Detective Chubb calls Batman and tells him to get there pronto because they have another victim. When Batman arrives, he learns the victim is Commissioner Beckett. Man Ray first went after a sex trafficker and then a racist. These victims were targeted. Some of the cops decide they are going to find Commissioner Beckett's murder and kill him. Next, we have the assault on Batman.
Man, this guy is just brutal, Drew. I mean, even his weapon that he uses is just, I mean, it's certainly not the most dangerous thing we've seen, but like, it, you could, it's one of those things, like, that's just brutal, right? Like an iron with spikes on it, that's, there's no finesse in that, right? That is just sheer violence.
Yeah, and I think it kind of threw Jace off his game when he gets hit by it. He definitely wasn't ready to take on a villain of this caliber. This is a Joker-type character, and I have a feeling this is might be this Batman's Joker. I'm not sure if that's what the author's wanting to do with this character, but that's what it felt like to me. Jace is at the beginning of his Batman career, and we're seeing that here. You know, he gets scared and runs away. He doubts himself, wondering if he should be Batman or not, and we kind of see him regroup, you know, later on in the issue. So I really like this issue a lot, even though the Man Ray character is a little dark for me.
I really like this issue also, Drew. I'm not convinced that this character is supposed to be his Joker, because I do think Jace will take him down in the end. I think it's Jace's introduction to the level of savagery that you encounter when you find somebody like the Joker. And that really is what he was not ready for, right? Like, if that guy just kind of came at him hand to hand, I think Jace would have been fine, right? Even if that guy had been incredibly skilled, I think Jace would have handled that because he's prepared for that. He knows how to fight a normal fight. What he's not ready for is savagery, right? Pure evil. And that guy that he's fighting, that's what that completely throws him off his game. This guy isn't just dangerous, right? Like, he's just violence, right? And it's just, and that was, I think, really what took him off his game.
I got to tell you, Cletus, I found some of the Commissioner Beckett scenes disturbing when he was cutting them up. I was like, this is a little graphic.
Yeah, well, and then especially the way he gets strung up at the end where it's just like his torso. Brutal. Just brutal. It's effective, though, right? Because we completely understand what this character is. I mean, it is just, like I said, it's pure violence.
Yeah. The series continues to surprise me with how good it is, and, you know, this being a totally different Batman, it's being its own thing. I'm really glad that the author and DC allowed him to move Batman, this Batman, to New York, his own place, let him do his own thing, because I think it's really good.
I agree. He's very well suited to his own city, for sure.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, Green Lantern number 12. John Stewart has the power to help his people, and he's going to use it. The Source comes to John and tells him his plan is not going to work. Using the Godstorm's power to stabilize the spectral energies with the magical will take every bit of energy that John has. John Stewart unleashes a wave of energy that sweeps across Oa and beyond. The ships in orbit around Oa report that everything on the ships have been reset to its original state, like it was fresh out of the shipyard on its maiden voyage. Guardian City has undergone significant repair. The Xeroxy Terrace and the Mad Guardian are gone. The other Guardians seem to have been destroyed. A massive ball of energy now rests where the central power battery once stood. Hal Jordan states he feels energy trickling out of it like a lighthouse beacon. Hal stretches out his hand toward the energy ball, and suddenly, he's in his Green Lantern uniform, wearing the ring he originally received from Abin Sur. Martian Manhunter confirms that the healing wave only affected technology. There are only 600 Green Lanterns currently on Oa, and 53 of them are critically injured. Hal tells Martian Manhunter to get everyone who is able and every ring and bring them to the beacon. Hal gives a speech and has all the lanterns concentrate on creating the rings. Reciting the oath, the Green Lanterns are back. Well, except for a few hiccups. We see that Isolde is angry with Jordan because she's now a Star Sapphire, and we see that Chip is a Blue Lantern. Simon Baz is disappointed he didn't become a Green Lantern when suddenly all the rings start flying into the air and talking to him. Simon touches one and he's talking to Arisia, who asks Simon if she has died. All the other lanterns look at Simon perplexed. There are only 600 lanterns left, and the Guardians are gone. John Stewart states that too much power corrupts, and the source disagrees and states that power reveals. John Stewart returns to the Dark Sector, Aniska Prime, the slaver hub world. John tells all the slavers they have 10 minutes to vacate the planet. It is now under the protection of the Emerald Knight. John Stewart and the Emerald Knights will return. And when I read that, I was wondering, is this a miniseries? Because I was not sure.
Drew, I feel I'm slightly conflicted because, in a sense, I really like how this ended in that it basically hit the factory reset button on the Green Lanterns, right? It just sort of boop, and now everything's back to the way it was with slight differences. Like a couple of the Green Lanterns are now different lanterns, which is interesting. But on the other hand, more importantly, what the hell is the point of this story, Drew? They're the ones that made all of these stupid, ridiculous, absurd changes that required a factory reset to undo them in the first place. Ah, Drew, what was the point? What was the point? If for any of our listeners who are considering, on the off chance, of who haven't been getting this book monthly and we're considering potentially getting a trade of this, just don't. Having read none of it, you stand exactly where you would be if you had read the entire thing, because ultimately nothing changes.
Just a few minor things. We've got John Stewart with all this power all of a sudden. I don't know what they're planning on doing with him. It sounds like he might be off doing his own thing, or he's going to be the Guardian now. I don't know. We do have a couple characters that aren't Green Lanterns anymore. We have Chip, who's a Blue Lantern, and we have Iolade, who's a Star Sapphire now. But according to this story, all the other Lanterns are gone, and they don't even mention the Sinestro Corps. So I'm thinking they're still around. But where are they going to go from here? Are we bringing all these different Lanterns, are they all going to be based off Oa now, all connected to this big colorful ball that's there instead of the battery? Is this creative team going to keep writing? Is this title an ongoing, or is it a mini series? I don't know. I don't know what's going on now.
Part of me wonders, Drew, if, and this is hopeful speculation, especially because you know that this book was actually finished months ago and it's been published now. My hope is with Discovery having purchased Warner Bros. That they maybe looked at some of what they're doing with some of these books and were like, hey, what the hell are we doing with Green Lantern right now? This doesn't seem accessible. That's my biggest problem with it, Drew, is how was this book supposed to bring new Green Lantern readers to the table? I don't know how. It required far too much pre-existing Green Lantern knowledge. But then it's also, in my opinion, not doing anything to actually appeal to people who do know Green Lantern lore. So it was just like it was the worst of both worlds. It was like, what is this mess of a book trying to do? And then ultimately nothing. Ultimately it just hit the factory reset button, which is good, thank God. But they did that to themselves. All the things that they undid were things that this writing team came up with. It's not like they reset all the way back to Geoff Johns, right? It's not like they just undid years of Green Lantern stuff. They undid their own run. It's inexplicable. Drew, I can't imagine that this was their goal initially with this book. I just can't fathom that. And so unless DC literally came to them and was like, we need to keep publishing Green Lantern because we gotta, but also we don't really want you to do anything with it. We kind of just want you to spin your wheels. Unless that was the mission statement, which I guess theoretically is possible, something had to have changed in the background with this, right?
Yeah, I agree with you because it was going one direction and then like you said, they just kind of restarted, so I bet you there was some sort of something behind the scenes that happened where they had to change direction. And I hope to God we get regular Green Lantern stories moving forward. Hopefully with a different creative team, because I didn't really care for this one.
No, they were terrible. The only thing I can give them a credit for is I do like making Jessica Cruz a Yellow Lantern. I think that's really interesting. And I like the idea of mixing it up and making some lanterns that we know and changing their alignment, so to speak, as a different lantern. That's a little interesting. But that's it. The most interesting things that they did, Drew, is when they actually bothered to do real lantern stuff, which was almost never.
They didn't even explore the Jessica thing. We were, both of us were really interested in learning more about what was, you know, having some stories with her. They never did any. I don't know where, I don't know if we're getting an issue 13, if this story's done. I haven't seen anything, so I guess we'll just have to keep our eyes peeled and see. I'm hoping that a new creative team or a new, something new is coming out of this, and it's not going to be the same old, same old. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week. Superman, Son of Kal-El, number 10. Lex Luthor calls a press conference and does not have nice things to say about Superman, Jonathan Kent, basically calling him a murderer. A storm breaks out over the Atlantic and hits Ireland with winds over 100 miles per hour. The spire of Dublin falls, sending 126 tons of stainless steel crashing into nearby buildings, trapping people inside. When Superman shows up to save them, the people are not happy to see him. Superman saves them, and a little girl tells John she believes in him. Dick and Babs call John to check in on him. John tells them that he just saved some people that were more scared of him than being crushed to death. Lois Lane speaks up at the press conference. When Lois reveals the truth that Nightwing was a witness, Lex asks if the public is supposed to believe the word of a masked vigilante known to terrorize the police force of Bloodhaven. Lois replies that actually she thought the public would rely on your word, Lex, and pulls the lasso of truth from her purse. Go ahead, speak your truth. If you have nothing to hide, I'm sure you won't mind answering some questions in front of the world. Just reach out and tell me. Is President Bendis trying to frame my son for murder? Lex leaves the stage. Back at the Kent apartment, Lois reveals to John and Jay that the lasso was just a rope Lois painted gold. Batman shows up at the apartment and tells them it's not safe here anymore. The Justice League is going to move Lois and John to a safe house, and their grandparents are already there. John wants Jay to come, but Batman says no. Batman states he knows where Jay came from, and he knows who Jay's working for. Batman states you cannot trust Jay Nakamura.
I don't really have a ton to comment with this one, Drew. It was pretty good. it's interesting that potentially his boyfriend is a potentially antagonistic, although I don't fully buy that that'll be the case. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, I was curious about that too, because I the writer has gotten us to trust him. So, but Batman stating you can't trust him, I don't know. It throws stuff into doubt because it's Batman. I trust Batman more. So, I don't know. Well, I guess we'll have to see. My favorite part of this issue was Lois Lane pulling out the lasso of truth. And Lex basically freaking out. I thought that was great. I loved it. It was my favorite part of this issue. And, Tom Taylor continues to make me really enjoy this title, because his stuff can be kind of uplifting and fun. And, it has stuff like that, Lois pulling out the lasso of truth, even though find out later she just painted rope gold and was calling Lex's bluff. But I'm really enjoying his stuff a lot.
I particularly have enjoyed his Nightwing run. I feel like his Jonathan Kent book has been pretty good, to be clear. It's also a good book, but I feel like it hasn't had the same high notes that like the dog issue in Nightwing, for example, that was mostly silent and we were just kind of following throughout the book. You know what I mean? Like, it's been good, but it's been more like consistently like a 6 or 7 out of 10. And Nightwing has had a couple like 10 out of 10s.
Now, I have to agree with you. I have liked the night his Nightwing series a little more than this one, but I've been enjoying them both, so. All right, well, let's move on to our last title for this week, Wonder Woman number 786. Each champion is given a tool to aid them in the contest, but the tool can be used once. Yara Flor is given a bow and arrow to hunt. Donna Troy is given a knotted lariat in order to solve the puzzle. Philippus is given a compass to help navigate the path ahead. Diana will carry a sword, a weapon of war, courage, and justice. It represents peace through strength and battle as a last resort. Altuum, the survivor, blows a horn. The champions fall into a sinkhole, a cavern hidden under the arena. Not even Diana knew this cavern was there. Philippus uses the compass to show the way to what they need to find. The Amazons find Echidna, a half-woman, half-snake monster from the swamps of Tartarus, the mother of all monsters. Diana states that her mother, Hippolyta, had once beheaded Echidna. Echidna states, "If you cut off my head, I'll just grow another." Echidna explains that she was set free by the sound of a horn made from her own offspring, the Chimera. Its call gave Echidna the strength to break her bonds. Donna Troy uses her rope and lasso around Echidna's neck. Echidna states that she knows Troya the Darkstar. Donna tells her to call her Donna. Yara Flor shoots Echidna in the eye with an arrow. Philippus and Yara open Doom's doorway. The four Amazons push the monster through Doom's doorway. As the four Amazons are pushing Echidna through the Doom's doorway, a voice calls out to Diana stating, "You promised me redemption. You lied." Diana replies, "Chaos!" The room begins to collapse. Diana holds up the debris and tells the other three Amazons to get out of there. Diana tells the Amazons to give Nubia a message. "Tell Nubia it is chaos." To be continued in Trial of the Amazons Wonder Girl number 2.
Drew, you certainly called the involvement of those forgotten people. Although it was weird again that he kind of popped up and then went away again.
I was like, is he on the island or is he somewhere else? I was confused with where exactly he was, because they didn't actually tell us where he was. He just kind of showed up for, it looked like maybe a panel or two, blew that horn and left. It was gone. It was weird.
My interpretation, this certainly could be wrong, was that he was underground, like deep under Thanoskira, which I think is consistent with what was implied by his story that we got before, was that they were sort of underneath the current island. So I don't know. I'm still not fully convinced that he and his people are really the threat behind all of this, though. But I mean, there are certainly signs pointing towards that potentially being the case.
Yeah, it still feels like something that's behind Doom's doorway that's causing all the problems.
Yeah, but I agree. I know, and again, I know he popped up, and you certainly called that, but I'm just not convinced yet that he and his people are the true threat. Like you said, I think it's something with Doom's doorway. I'm still not convinced it's not something connected to Medusa.
Yeah, that's possible, and they haven't really focused on Medusa's for a few issues, so I mean, it certainly could come back to that. We definitely got the start of the trials here, but it did not feel like any competition to me. They really had to work together to accomplish their goal, and whether this was the actual trial they were going through that was supposed to be done by the gods or just something that happened to interfere with their trials, it was still great to watch the Amazons work together. And I have no clue how they're going to decide who is champion. Other than if we're going to stick somebody at the door, it's probably going to be Philippus. So.
so far, Drew, with this story, it feels really disjointed, hopping from creative team to creative team. And I think that's somewhat inevitable when you don't have one writer sort of overseeing the whole thing. But I've been a little disappointed at how choppy this story has felt so far. Like, each individual issue hasn't necessarily been bad. There's not that flow that you would want in an event like this.
Yeah, they should have almost done a miniseries separate from these titles just to tell this story to get it more cohesive. I agree with you, Cletus. And some issues are better than the others. I mean, the Wonder Girl issues have been really good just because it's Joel Jones. So, but I have to agree with you. It's been choppy. All right. We also had a backup story in this. Young Diana. The Gardens of Themyscira. Georgina tells Hippolyta and Diana that they are helpful in a way that means Lena must check everything they do twice. She's learning a lot. Lena mentions Georgina's drawings, and Hippolyta decides Georgina needs to spend more time with Io working in her workshop. Georgina returns later very excited with her plan, with the plans her and Io came up with. Lena tells Georgina that she can handle the farm by herself. Hippolyta tells Diana as they are leaving the farm that all creatures want happiness, security, and success. Give your people that, and you'll have their loyalty forever. Deny them these basic needs and you risk failure, resentment, and pain. Growth is essential. Diana and Hippolyta come across Antiope, who tells Diana they have much to talk about. To be continued. This story kind
I just don't totally get the point of this story, Drew. This entire thing has just been like garden time with the Amazons, and it's fine, I guess, but like, Why do we need to read it?
Okay. The two stories kind of don't make sense, but it felt like Hippolyta did this on purpose to give Diana a teaching moment. But really, if you go back to the story and look at it, that's not what it seemed like at first. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just weird. And I think we should just leave it at that.
Agreed.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic book talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
At the 42cast, we want to bring you everything, and that's why we've jam-packed the next few months with as much as we can. You not only get the same reviews, topics, and interviews that you did before, you also get screen reads, where we compare a movie to its source material, or Role Models, where we talk about tabletop gaming. It's never been a more exciting time to check out our show. It's your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything, so why not check it out? We can be found on most podcasting platforms, and we are a proud member of the ESO Network.
I'm Mark McCray, the author of The Best Saturdays of Our Lives. And if you're not listening to our podcast, then you're missing out on amazing interviews with
Larry Houston,
Tom Tatawanovich,
Keone Young,
Michael Swanigan,
Ned Hastings,
Bill Gollier,
Dan Gilvezan,
Rob Lamb,
and so many others.
Kick back and let Dan Klink and I peel back the curtain on the animation industry.
The Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast can be found on the ESO Network and all podcasting platforms.
And we're back. Let's talk The Flash, Season 8, Episode 12, Death Rises. Deathstorm tells Caitlin he's come to end all life. Deathstorm attacks Caitlin, but The Flash shows up and saves her. Caitlin tells the team that Ronnie's death gave Deathstorm life. When Ronnie was gone, it became something more, something incomplete. Caitlin helped to make it whole again by modifying the Firestorm Matrix. Barry gets a text from Sue that Iris is back. Barry figures out that Iris's time sickness pulled her into the Steel Force, saving her life. Captain Kramer calls in the Flash because they are getting reports all over Central City about a skull-faced demon who is burning his victims. The current theory is that it's feeding off of people's grief. Captain Kramer puts the city on lockdown and tries to get everyone off the street. Cops are not to engage the skull-faced demon, but to call in Team Flash so they can deal with the monster. The Steel Force comes to Iris. Dion states he's getting infected too. Dion could only see what happened to Tinya's mother once it became part of the past. Dion can see everyone's future except for Iris's. Dion creates a way to track Iris. Dion states that something is wrong and then disappears in a flash of green energy. Chester hooks up Cecile's empath powers to a machine to find Deathstorm. Chester locates Deathstorm at Star Labs. Deathstorm takes over Cecile to tell Flash that he cannot stop him. Allegra gets attacked by Deathstorm, but this time he's disguised as her cousin, Esperanza. Allegra is not sure why Deathstorm decided to target her. Deathstorm attacks Frost and kidnaps Caitlin. Flash chases after him. Deathstorm is flying and Barry is unable to reach him. Using his boots' new abilities, Flash runs on lightning blasts, allowing him to run across the sky. When Flash catches up to Deathstorm, Deathstorm enters a portal and disappears. Deathstorm takes Caitlin to Ripley's Wild World and then starts attacking other people. Caitlin watches in horror as Deathstorm feeds off of them. Deathstorm tells Caitlin he doesn't want to kill her. He wants to make her his bride, but she's not ready yet. Team Flash discovers a way to create an anti-Deathstorm and Frost volunteers. Eddie Thawne shows up in Coast City and tells Iris he is happy to see her.
I remember saying this last time, Drew, when I was talking about how much they nailed the look of Deathstorm, that I wasn't sure how well it would work in motion, and that was apparent almost immediately when you saw how much they struggled to try and animate his talking motion. Brutal. I understand, and like, my expectations aren't that high, so I'm not going to hold it against them, but it's about exactly what I was expecting. I was like, man, that character design is great, but it is not going to animate well, and that's exactly what happened.
And I guess that's what we should expect from their budget, huh?
Right. Wait, and again, I understand, Drew, I understand. And if you've got to pick one, I feel like that's about as good as it could possibly get on the CW, so I'm not going to ding them for it. The whole Bride of Frankenstein thing is kind of dumb, I guess. It doesn't really make sense for what Deathstorm is. I don't know. I'm sure what they're trying to get at is that the whatever this thing is that sort of merged with Ronnie has, in a sense, too much of Ronnie still intact, right? Which is probably what's motivating all of this. I don't know. It's just still, it's kind of silly because I feel like it takes this character that is theoretically a pretty intense threat and really waters it down pretty significantly, because if we're dealing with like Blackest Night Deathstorm, right, he's just going to murder the entirety of Central City. I understand that we're not going to actually see that on the show, but that would be his goal. Whereas this is sort of just like, I just want the pretty girl to go back with me to my world. You know what I mean? Like, that's such a... That's a lot worse, Drew. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, I got to tell you, Cletus, because I agree with you. But, you know, towards the beginning of the episode when Deathstorm is killing all these people in Central City, it felt like that. And I got to agree with you. It definitely shifted with when he announced that he wanted to make Caitlin his bride, because then it just kind of got stupid. Because they were... I felt like they were doing the threat of Deathstorm fairly well, killing all these people. Oh, they don't know how to stop them. We got locked down the city. And then they go and tells Caitlin he wants to make her his bride. And it just kind of turns it on its side. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. Well, and then the way that he's going about his plot too, where he keeps it appears to be slowly transforming her, but then just keeps leaving her. To be like, to essentially help Team Flash figure out how to stop him. And again, maybe you could be writing that as that's Ronnie trying to, in a sense, self-sabotage. Part of me seems dubious that the writing staff is doing that, if I'm being honest with you, Drew. But I don't know. And then going over to the Iris plot, man, Drew, these are just so disconnected. And it's neither one of these are you know, the worst plot we've seen recently from The Flash, but they don't go together. And it is frankly really distracting to hop back and forth between the two. I think they need to pick one. And I'm sure they've got to be connected somehow, but it is so nebulous at this point that it's just not working when you go back and forth between them.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I'm not really sure where they're going with the Iris thing right now. I mean, we just brought back Eddie, but I'm not sure why. I mean, is it because her tie is kind of, is she kind of unraveling time around her or something? I don't know. They've been, I don't know, maybe they're trying to be mysterious about it, but I don't think they're giving us enough yet. All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. DMZ Season 1, Episode 4, Home. The phone rings and Alma answers it. A woman's voice asks, where is Wilson? Alma states, Wilson is dead. You're dealing with me now. They agree to meet at the Lincoln Tunnel in 1 hour. Skill adds Wilson Lynn's name to his list. Alma meets with the woman from the phone, asking for safe passage for her and her son into the Free States. The woman wants Chinatown and a foothold in the DMZ. Alma offers a direct line to Susie. Skill is not happy that Parco is in bed with the United States. Parco tells Skill not to believe everything that woman says. Parco gives Skill the only other set of keys to a van that Parco has valuables in. Alma talks with Tenny and tells her that she saw how Christian looked at her and knows he loves her. Alma believes she can still get to her son. Tenny shows Alma that she is behind Radio DMZ. Tenny convinces Z to run against Parco in the election. Odie and Nico are tossing out pamphlets to vote for Z. Parco's men chase after him and then capture them. Parco has a talk with Odie, trying to convince him to help Alma by helping him with the FSA soldiers. Parco wants Odie to carry a bomb to the entrance of the FSA to stop them before they can come over and hurt Alma or any of them. Block them before they can enter onto this island. We see that Skell overhears everything. Skell checks out Parco's van and finds it full of C4. Alma comes looking for Parco. Alma tells Parco to call off the U.S. Alma tells Parco he's becoming everything he hated when he had returned from Afghanistan. What's worse is that Parco is doing it to their own son. Parco pulls a gun on Alma. Alma states, if you kill me, you lose Skell. Parco's second in command goes to shoot Alma in the head. Skell shoots him instead. Skell has Alma get into the car and they go after Odie. Alma is able to intercept Odie and have him put the backpack down and run. Alma is able to destroy the detonator. Parco comes after Alma himself. Parco realizes Skell is helping Alma. Parco tells Skell to get out of his way, and Parco goes to shoot Skell, but the gun does not fire. Skell takes down Parco. Skell takes Parco to the U.S. border. He tells him to leave his boots. Alma states that they are the only friends you have now. Parco is arrested for attempting to unlawfully enter the United States. Alma gives Skell a chance to start over, but he's not coming with him. Alma is staying behind. This is her calling. Tenny is there to meet him. Last thing Alma says to Christian is eyes forward love. Alma receives an envelope from Tenny and is told to open it in private. Alma gives the envelope to Odie and tells him to take what it says seriously and that it's his secret. Odie plays the last broadcast of Tenny announcing Z is the winner of the election. The DMZ cheers at a new beginning as they watch the U.S. soldiers leave their border. Which, if you ask me, Cletus, makes no sense whatsoever.
I mean, none of it makes much sense, Drew. Again, it makes sense when you know that the same people that adapted Naomi also adapted this. It answers a lot of the questions I have when I watch this show. Because again, I've not read DMZ, but I read enough of a summary that I'm not saying I have an intimate understanding of the plot. Don't get me wrong. But I know loosely how the story goes. And I just don't understand the changes that they made to the show are almost exclusively for the worst, Drew. I mean, making Z the main character is fine. That's okay. That I have no problem with that. But some of the changes that they made make the show more confusing and do things that make, like, they put themselves in worse storytelling positions for no reason. They're unforced errors. It's like making Superman not exist and then changing your mind 40 minutes into the episode and be like, no, just kidding, he does exist. You know, it's just... Drew, she's been in the DMZ for a week at most, and all of a sudden everybody believes in her and she wins this election. Also, they run an actual election in a place that is run by gangs. It somehow has an airtight voting system. What, Drew?
I know. I found that hilarious myself.
And again, and also some of the changes are also just a little confusing. Now, again, I want to be clear that I might have some stuff a little bit wrong because I've not read the book. But my understanding from the book is that in the comics, the FSA is the revolter. I'm sure that's the same in the show. But it's basically like the U.S. is distracted overseas. They're too overextended overseas. The National Guard is not able to respond to an insurrection, essentially. And they get way further than they ever expected. It's essentially like the flyover states, like what maybe a little, like I know Oregon's not a flyover state, but like kind of like what we saw in Oregon a few years ago. It's basically that, but there's no one there to stop them. And so they just sort of almost accidentally half win a war, right? And that's where the story just kind of picks up, is that out of nowhere, the U.S. Army wasn't able to respond quickly enough. They got way further than they expected. Then they unexpectedly win a battle, and it pushes the U.S. back. And then the story just kind of goes from there, where they're at this stalemate around the DMZ. But, Drew, in other words, the FSA in that is not going to be, let's be honest here, they're not going to be the ones that Z goes to have her son go for asylum. I'm just saying, Drew, politically speaking, not going to be aligned with what she wants. And yet that's what they do in the show, and they make the U.S. is clearly the antagonist, even more so, weirdly, than the FSA, which, again, makes sense because they've not defined what either of the sides believe in, other than that the USA is clearly bad. But why, Drew? I can buy that. If you want to make that change, I'm fine with that. But tell me why. Why is the USA so clearly bad? The DMZ is, I know I keep beating this dead horse, but the DMZ is shown to not be a good place to live. And yet they are adamant that it is better than being a part of either side. Why, Drew? You have to answer that question.
And they definitely don't here. We never get that answer.
It's just, and the big thing again, so they constantly paint themselves into plot corners that they can't get out of other than to just magic themselves out of it. The main character benefits wildly at all times, inexplicably. This happens in both shows. And it's one of the things, it's also frustrating watching this, Drew, because I think you and I both kind of knew what was going to happen. By the end of the first episode, I felt like it was pretty obvious that Z was going to end up being the leader of the DMZ, which makes no sense whatsoever, logically. But you kind of knew that that was what was going to happen. Like, I was sitting, it felt, these episodes felt like a formality. Like, I wasn't surprised really by almost anything in the show. It was like, well, she's going to get her son back. Parco's going to lose. And she's inexplicably going to become the leader of everything because she's the main character. And that's what happened. Like, you know what I mean? Like, none of that was shocking.
I totally agree with you. I wasn't shocked by it at all. They basically laid it out, like you said, in the first episode, and we watched it play out.
And even little moments were surprising. Like, as soon as Parco doesn't shoot her, you're like, oh, well, her son's going to show up and shoot the henchman before, because he's going to talk for 2 minutes too long. And that's going to give enough time for her son to inexplicably show up exactly where they're at and kill him. And what happens? Exactly that. Like, it's just, it's all of it. It was just so paint by the numbers, but it just, oh, Drew, it is shocking how bad this show turned out. Given the budget, the actors that they got for this, the fact that I know not every HBO show is good. Don't get me wrong. Like, we all know how Game of Thrones ended. But, like, wow, Drew, wow. I just am stunned at how bad this show ended up being.
Yeah, it was a disappointment, that's for sure. All right, well, that wraps up our show for this week. Did you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah, I wanted to shout out Blackest Night just because I feel like they're adapting. There's some really subtle things that I'm enjoying that The Flash is adapting from that. Obviously, like we've said, they've nailed the look of Deathstorm from that. But also when he initially, like, when he goes to the carnival and he scans the crowd and he senses the despair or whatever, that is very similar, Drew, to when we, in Blackest Night, when they, like, see the different emotions in characters. Like, they see a character and they're glowing blue because they're filled with hope, or they're glowing green.
internally because they have a bunch of willpower. I thought that was a really good, subtle kind of adaptation of that. That was really cool. And it's been longer than you think. Like, I don't think of Blackest Night as that old of a story, but it's been a while. It has been a while. Definitely, I think it's worth going back and revisiting that book because it's a great DC story. Like, obviously, Green Lantern is the focus of it, but what a great story.
It is. I've thought about going back and revisiting it. I can tell you that. All right, and for my shout-out, I'm going to shout-out about... Well, I got actually two shout-outs. The first one is Batman Mask of the Phantasm, because after reading the Batman Catwoman story, I wanted to go back and rewatch the movie because it's been a while since I saw it. And it's on HBO Max, so I actually fit that into... I don't know how I did it, but I fit it into my schedule this week. Went back and watched Batman Mask of the Phantasm and really enjoyed rewatching it. My second shout-out is Doctor Strange, The Multiverse of Madness. Cletus, that was so awesome.
Oh, it's so good. I was excited when they first announced the movie and they said that Scarlet Witch was going to be a part of it. It was really exciting for me because I'm a big fan of her character in the comics. You know, Avengers Disassembled, House of M. Uncanny Avengers is one I'd recommend checking out with Rick Remender, which is, you know, comes out years after the House of M stuff. So she's a character I really like, and I was thrilled to see that she was in this movie, and has a lot more screen time than she's had in, like, the Avengers. And then I like Doctor Strange better in this than in the first one. This was just... I much prefer the sequel to the original Doctor Strange film, so I highly recommend people go check it out. It's a great, great movie.
I have to agree with you. I enjoyed this one better than the first one also. So, check it out. It doesn't... at least it didn't disappoint me. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message, or you could email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we've got Batman Superman World's Finest, Batman the Knight, Blue and Gold, Catwoman, Nightwing, The Flash, Trial of the Amazons, Wonder Girl, and of course our DC television shows, The Flash, Naomi, and Superman and Lois. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Time to go.
You sure this is necessary?
The Guardians of the Universe seem to think so.
How long will you be gone? But we will be back, little brother.
I wish I could go with.
I doubt your mother would approve.
I'll miss you.
Perhaps you could water the plants in my apartment while I am gone.
Be careful, all right?
May the gods be with you all.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.